Thanks, Sarah. I started to introduce this project we have been working on called the Dark Renormalization Group. It's DMRG generalization via differentiable programming. So I will introduce this project in the follow order. And first, let me talk about why we're doing this. So the motivation is we have two major motivations. The first motivation comes from some physics observations. So the problem we want to solve is a simulation problem that is given a K local Hamiltonian in this form, and a local observable O, where each OI and HI act at most K sites, and an initial state rho zero. We ask you to compute the expectation value at a complex time t, which the expectation value is defined by the trace. If you try to do some numerics, you will find that lots of system with local interaction are kind of well behaved when you enlarge them. By well behaved, it means it does not fluctuate a lot. It just stays in a small range. And eventually, when you keep enlarging, the system will eventually saturate. So on the right-hand side is an example of a transfer Ising model evolved by different time and different size. You can see here for a bit shorter time, it already saturates very early. And for even for a longer time, it's still only fluctuating a very small range. So the reason why this we have this is actually because of the locality of interactions. So this is a very early result called Leib-Robinson bound, where the local interaction limits how observables can spread. This is also true for ground states. So this is even more obvious for TFIM. The ground state energy is almost linear in this way and is pretty predictable. So this indicates the following hypothesis. If we're given an oracle access to all the observables in the previous smaller size system, minus one, minus two, until some C0, small C0, we ask you to use all these information to solve the simulation problem at n size system again, this might be a simpler problem.
Great. Maybe so your first plot there, yeah. Your claim here is that this is all well behaved, but I don't know if the number of sites increase except for t equals 2.5. It looks like the opposite. It looks like it's not well behaved.
It kind of the oscillating a small range. Like by well behaved, we mean like it doesn't just suddenly go to a super large number and then decrease to zero. Like can't tell what the number is. But here you can see it's
The scale is 0.1, right?
yeah, it's all stays in this 0.2, 0.1 range.
What's that figure supposed to show us, that second one, the circle?
So this is trying to show like how the when you have a bipartite system and you have your red system interact with the blue system has only local interactions, and local observables cannot spread too fast. Yeah.
Sorry, you still have me confused. What is the red glow and what is the blue thing and what is the spread? Is there some ridge or something that tells you right from just by looking at the diagram how the things are spreading?
Oh yeah. So when time evolved, the entire system, the observable on the red system, so the effect on the observable of the red system cannot and the correlation on your ground state of the red system and the blue system will not grow super fast or limited in a certain state.
Just
It's a little vague, actually. Okay, anyway.
No, I think probably a better figure for this would be like, you know, those Lightcom diagrams? Probably that would communicate the idea of better.
Do the Lightcom. Everyone gets the Lightcom. Yeah, this is, I don't know, this is just like a single frame, right? This is a square.
Yeah,
Maybe
it's
some
not
animation.
that
Yeah,
much of it.
but I mean, you can't put animation in this. It's some sort of new blender or whatever. But the light cone, you know, just space time, you know, like different layer and something.
So what is qualitatively, sorry, rather quantitatively, what is super fast here? What kind of speed are we talking about?
The speed of so the original labels Robinson have several so one of the bounds is when you change a little bit part of the system, the difference of observable in the rest system has an upper bound, and that has a hyperbolic spread, which is a Lightcon.
Maybe a small comment, but like if it's K local and if you take your computer science to sense of K locality, then the Robinson bound would be like there's still a bound, but it's not very like it's not very slow, it's like exponentially fast, right? So maybe are you talking about geometrically local Hamiltonians?
Yeah, geometric
Yeah,
local.
maybe, yeah, because in the posing of the problem you mentioned K local, so that might be
So
confusing.
K local means like you have a two body object, it could be infinite range, right? Okay, yeah, right, that's a good point.
So then the, I mean, there's the
You know the difference, Roger? Yeah, that makes sense because you have K local here, but it could be.
I guess it should more precisely, it should be geometric local.
Yeah, we could, yeah. Like Rydberg is two local, right?
Yeah,
Yeah.
so I mean, K local could be like a full Wilson group, right?
Yeah.
That spans the entire system.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, that's a good point, thanks.
Okay. So the other motivation is the usage of automatic differentiation. Let me give you a quick recap on what automatic differentiation is. So basically, it just allows you to do one thing. If you give me a function fx, and I'll tell you what the gradient is automatically. And this is done by applying the chain rules. And because most of the function when you're writing a program is a composition of elementary functions, so you can easily doing automatically figure out the gradients by either doing Jacobian vector product or vector Jacobian product. So to give you more concrete feeling on what this is, so on right-hand side is a piece of Python code I copy from AutoGrid. So here we define a tangent to H function, and the automatic differentiation engine allows you to directly ask for the gradient of this cast your custom defined function. And we're currently in an age of automatic differentiation after almost 60 years of development, from all the way to 1960s to re until recently. There's a blooming of all the automatic differentiation implementations in software, and the new rules being figured out. So the toolbox is rather complete recently. So we have automatic differentiation on almost all the hardware we can get, CPU, GPU, and TPU. And we have the reverse mode rules and software for and figure out for eigen solvers and ODE solvers. And in recent years, we see many development of differentiable solvers for a quantum system. So a natural question is, can we make use of these tools for many body system? And we haven't seen a differentiable solver used for solving a many body system problem. This two motivation motivates us to think about this if we can find a way to make to utilize the locality and make use of the automatic differentiation tools. Our inspiration actually comes from the early idea from Wilson RG and DMRG. This comes from the very first beautiful and simple idea from Wilson about the numerical RG. If you want to reach a target system size, each target, we just need to, and if the system can keep growing, then we just need to start from a small system, H1, and truncate the compressed matrix of H1, such that some property of H1 is preserved. Then we add a few more size and repeat until the full system is reached. So on the right-hand side is a standard DMRG, infinite DMRG procedure with environment blocks that address the boundary effects.
Is that right from Schoenberg's paper?
Yeah.
That environment block is backwards, isn't it? Anyway, that's
yeah.
Because you use a tensor, right? The two red sites.
It is the right direction. It is the right. It's just to copy your the system block. It's not in the middle. This is something a little bit confusing at first when I tried to implement the original paper.
I implemented it, and you tensor product the two reds together.
Yeah.
So, but it doesn't matter.
But you will actually see why get some feeling why you should copy paste your system block as your environment block later in our theory because that offers you some other parts of the of the system. If we review the these two early methods from a perspective in a loss function with a mapping, we can write this table. So the Wilson RG, the property trying to preserve is defined by this loss function that trying to preserve the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, and it uses that sum tree as the mapping. While the DMRGs, White finds that if you actually want to calculate the property of a state, this loss function is suboptimal. You should optimize on the arbitrary observable of a state. So you change the loss function, and then you have the DMRG. This is why it is originally called DMRG, because now you're redefining this loss function on density matrix. So we can see that the relationship compared to the traditional RG is you swap the cross-graining with the compression function here, which is our asymmetry. And you define the fixed point, you switch the fixed point to a loss function that defines what property you want to preserve. So a natural question from this is, can we generalize the mapping and loss function? Do they have to be a symmetry, or do they have to be like this?
Wilson RG versus Wilsonian RG versus Wilson NRG. Numerical renormalization group NRG.
This is NRG.
I'm just saying about RG. So
you should write it as NRG, maybe?
I don't know. There's some old hand guys that flat. Just because numerically that doesn't work, right?
Yeah, because the loss function is wrong.
Yeah, so I put NRG just to clarify.
Okay.
Just a small.
So in order to generalize this method, we need some inspiration and another inspiration from programming language community, which comes from typing and programming concepts. So this is also why this is named as duck typing, named as duck RG. So So we use the idea of duck typing here. So the traditional typing is the inherence relationship. When A inherits B, this is true only if A is a special case of B. For example, dog needs to inherit from animal, duck needs to inherit from bird. But duck typing says it don't have to be strictly inherent to this. You don't have to write it down. We won't care about what we can do. So for example, mallet can be used as a duck because it quacks like a duck and swims like a duck. So it must be a duck. So the difference is the relation of traditional typing is strict and static, and the relation and the duck typing is dynamic and flexible. If you code Python, you will see this duck typing trick a lot. And the other thing is the differentiable programming. So what is differentiable programming? The traditional programming is we write down everything step by step in a strict and well-defined and precise way. So one classic example is the sorting algorithms, how to sort a list of numbers. We have a well-defined and well-analyzed algorithm that you know when what the complexity and when will stop. But for differentiable programming, we don't care about the details. We just sketch out the workflow first, parameterize the details, and we define what output we want with the loss function. And then we let gradient descent figure out the details. So example of this is the feedback control of a robot by differentiate through a simulator. So with this idea, combine them together, we're able to formalize and develop a theory for to generalize the original method. So first, we need to know what exactly the workflow of the DMRGA is. So here we let me walk through how you do the DMRG step by step. So here the left hand side is an infinite DMRG example. The right hand side is going to be the workflow, the flow chart of the workflow. So first we start with system one, which is the one block of system plus one physical site. And then we truncate them to a smaller size of block. A block is an object contains all your relevant operators like Hamiltonian, observable, and density matrix. And then we grow the system again. So if this is two sites, this is still two sites, and now this represents three sites. And then we can do the truncation again and grow again. And then in the end, we'll reach a four-site system.
Can you please explain how you go from two to three sites and then later on you go from three to four sites? How are you increasing?
Yeah, so in like the first line, right, the block and then the red bit. So block in that is one site only?
Mm-hmm. Block is you can see it's a one site system only.
And then you truncate to one site.
So you truncate to a smaller space size, but it still represents the same system. So for example, if this block is one site, we add one site to it and truncate them to get and two side system is for example a 4x4 matrix. You can use a truncation, compress this matrix to for example 3x3. So this is gonna be smaller. And then we can add one more site. This will be 6x6. And then we can do another truncation. It could be say 5x5. So this way you keep the storage complexity low and by keep truncating the system.
And what is the method of truncation that gives the actual representation field?
Sorry?
What is the method of
truncation?
Truncation.
So the truncation is a standard isometry mapping. So for example, a low rank approximation. It doesn't really limit you to how to perform the truncation, but usually people do low rank approximation because if it's a linear approximation, we know in theory that's the best truncation you can do.
And how are you cross-checking that this truncation is preserving the data that you still want to capture after truncation?
So remember, so I will actually talk about the why this preserve the information later, but remember at the beginning we reframe this as a optimizing a mapping based on a loss function. So as long as your loss function is minimized, we know that to preserve the quantity you want.
But maybe just to answer in practice for DMRG, the reason there is a system and an environment is, so the bottleneck is usually you diagonalize this exactly. So you have step S12 there, right? So you would diagonalize that exactly, and then you would form the reduced density matrix of say the left-hand side and truncate in the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So you can keep track of that weight that you're throwing away every time. People usually have a rule of thumb for those weights, like 10 to the minus 10.
Yeah.
10 to the minus 8.
Yeah.
And technically you don't always need an environment block. The reason why we use it here is to address some higher-order terms. I will also show you a more concrete equation later.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do it without environment block for some simple system. It still can give you okay result, but if you have a good environment estimation, it will give you a much better thing. So, here I just want to convey a vague idea how this workflow looks like. Because remember, when we talk about differentiable programming, we don't want to care about the details. We'll just parameterize. We don't want to see how we're going to truncate this. We just see we're going to truncate this. But how we're going to do it, we'll let gradient descent figure it out.
Sorry, what are the theta parameters? What are the parameters theta for the extending the system?
The theta is the mapping here. For DMRG is the asymmetry. But here the workflow is roughly have a function map one operator to the other, and it's a parameterized function. And we'll figure out what a function should be later.
The DMRG is fully deterministic, it's not a parameterized function.
Right. Yeah.
That's what he's generalizing.
Yes. And we can see later that the DMRG actually is a special case that you can know what the optimum point is. So now let's think about how we do differentiable programming. First, we sketch out the general workflow, which is this, and we have it. Now we need to define our abstraction, which is the object we want to use here. So what's inside a system? What inside a system we'll use is the Hamiltonian of the full system H, the observable one to calculate O, and the initial state rho. And then we need to figure out how to define what property we want to preserve. So we want to preserve the expectation value of our target observable in the final system size. And we want to preserve the ability of enlarge the system size so we can keep doing this process. So now before we actually figure out what condition we need to guarantee this thing, I need to throw you two definitions in order to keep going. So the first definition is a connecting operator. So a connecting operator is a pair of operator defines the interaction of two parts of the system. So the L operator L is an operator on your unsized system. And operator R is a mapping from L to the corresponding operator on the K-size system. For example, the transferal icing model is written this way. You have ZZ interaction on some IJ and the X on some single site. Then the connecting operator for N-size system is the z is a z operator, and the right hand side is another z operator. So imagine how you rewrite it Hamiltonian when you add a new site. How do you rewrite this in original form? So here is how you define the connecting operator. With the connecting operator, we can then define how we're gonna add one site to your Hamiltonian. So this is the growing operator. It is a super operator that increases the system size by k sites. So the effect of this operator is to map an n site operator to an n plus k site operator of the system. Or you can think this way. So I already have a Hamiltonian, like a transfer Ising model. How do I write an n plus one site Hamiltonian in the form of n site Hamiltonian? So you write it in this way. This is my n site Hamiltonian. I add one site. The connecting operator defines how this new site interact with my old system. So it interacts with the Z operator and my old LZ operator and a new single site operator on the new site. So if you're familiar with tensor network, this is actually the matrix product operator representation written in the algebra form. But the reason why we're doing algebra form is actually because the two following theorem want to prove, and we need to represent it in algebra. So the first thing is how do we preserve the ability to rescale? How do we make sure our compressed system can still scale like the, how you scale the old one? So on the right hand side, I draw a bit more blocks to represent the system after you grow it. So the first column is the original system without any truncation. These are your ground truths. They're gonna be super large. And every time you add a new site, the space is gonna grow exponentially. And here H12 means the second column is the system after one time truncation by this. And if you can keep growing that as well. And similarly, the third column is truncated twice. The fourth column truncates third times. And what it wants can be written if we define two operators. One is our growing operator GK, which add K size to your system. The other is a DK, where you apply F, your mapping, and compose with followed by a growing operator. So what we want is applying Q times GK, if our observable value on the inside state system denote that as P. So we want this to be smaller than error. And this DKQ is a system in your final target. So want this guy to be and this guy's observable have an error upper bound. And this condition is hard to directly evaluate because this is exponential thing and this is something further away. But there's a quite obvious theorem. I can give you a 1 second proof here. So if you want to, you can reduce this problem to the error between neighboring columns. So this column H4 minus H41, you insert identity as H4 minus H43 plus H3 minus H2 plus H2 minus H1. And then you find if we can make each column, the error between each column smaller than epsilon I, the final error will be sum of epsilon I. Will be upper bounded by sum of epsilon I. So this is a quite obvious theorem, but we find this condition that we name it as scaling consistency.
Sorry, I think I got confused because it seems like when you are defining the error, you are using a norm of some sorts. But then if you write the total error as the sum of individual absolute values of the errors, that just looks a little weird to me.
Sorry, the sum of individual error?
Yeah, aren't you using the absolute difference between H44 and H41 as epsilon?
Yeah.
How is that? How can you prove that that's going to be?
Because you can insert identity here, right? Mm-hmm. You can rewrite as H44 minus H43 plus H43 minus H42 plus.
What is the absolute value of the whole thing breaks down into sums of absolute values?
Yes, and then according to triangular inequality, right? It's the sum. It's epsilon is gonna be smaller than the. So you can find epsilon that is the sum of epsilon I.
I see.
Right. So that's your error bound.
I see. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we call this condition the scaling consistent condition because it requires you to be consistent when you do on scaling when you do a one truncation.
Mm-hmm. And each of the epsilon I can be different, independent.
The error here doesn't depend on each other. You can optimize them separately, but in practice, you might want to use the same F onsets everywhere. Then they are dependent on each other by theta, right?
Is that an equality or that total error should be less than or equal to the sum of all the independent errors?
The error should be less than sum of epsilon I. And epsilon I is the upper bound of the error you want to optimize. Yeah. So it must be something you can reach.
And the total error is like?
The total error will be sum of epsilon I.
And that would be like the max.
The upper bound.
Upper bound.
Yes.
It's the upper bound. So as long as you can reduce the upper bound, then you know, we know these two will get close. So next we need to figure out if we can further reduce this problem, because now this condition is still quite general because Q is some number that we don't know. We need to, we don't want to do arbitrary Q. And one nice property of local Hamiltonian or geometric local Hamiltonian is when you apply a growing operator, when you add some psi to the system, and you keep doing that. So here we have first ruler that we add one psi to the system, which is the red, add it here. And then you keep moving here until here. Sites you can interact with your environment is m minus one. If you move it further, there's nothing going to interact with the system. That means GKQ always have a special case that is the growing is adding a band, this band on your perimeter to your original system, and if you keep adding it, it won't change. Because it won't change the terms in your system. So we call this set of connecting operators, the overlapping set of connecting operators, because it's the overlapping part of connecting operators of your system environment. So that's so now we can always rewrite, find this special GKQ that's written in the form of which is in the form of only applying G one time, so we reduce this condition to only find a scaling consistency condition for this special GKQ. So in order to find that for so the last step is to find the condition for some target observable. So this is only one idea. Maybe there are other ways to find this condition, which we'll also discuss in the end. But we try to find this condition for use this idea. So the idea is if we want to find something constrained that we can just break our observable into pieces. And the pieces on your original system is the part that get changed because of your mapping F. And the part on the rest of the system on the environment is the part that won't change because your F won't apply on it. Now, as long as we can make sure our mapping doesn't change this part too much, it's smaller than some epsilon error, then we can have the final observable upper bounded by something, and as long with a reminder term, and as long as this term converge to some number, finite number, then this error will be upper bounded. Plus, if the remainder term is small enough, and we find the series expansion actually exists called the Dyson series of time-involved observable. And here's to give you a feeling how this decays. Here's numerics for five site transfer icing model evolved by five. So you can see that the observable A actually grows exponentially, but because of the prefactor, the actual remainder term is decreasing much faster. So to 10th order is already 10 to the negative 26. So with that, we find the second theorem, which is a little bit more complicated to prove, so I won't show the proof here. But the conclusion is you only need to optimize a bunch of correlation functions, n-time correlation functions that is a composition of your connecting operator and your final observable. And if those correlation function has an error smaller than epsilon, then the final observable's error will be upper bounded by this bound. So it's gonna be epsilon multiplies exponential time and the size of your overlapping sets, the size of this band, this yellow band, plus the remainder term. So this tells us what we need to optimize. So basically this is saying, we need to define our loss function as the error of these observables. And naturally, this actually, if you think F is an asymmetry map, this actually also gives you upper bound of MPS TDVP for each step. Because F is, if F is a symmetry, then optimizing this step on arbitrary O is equivalent to one step TDVP. So now we know how to what's the loss function. We can now define our algorithm. So the classical algorithm is just we figure out the we calculate the loss function, which is the error of these correlation functions.
Can I add something? So what does C in the exponent?
C is
the max.
The maximum spectrum. Because they are local operators, we just assume they have finite maximum spectrum.
And the norm of the DH actually is finite because it's considered geometrically local system.
The norm of what?
Delta H.
Delta H.
G in the
here.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the size of the band, of this band. So if it's a geometric local system. For example, if 1D, that's a constant, 2D is L, 3D is L squared.
But in 2D, wouldn't it be problematic if it blows up?
So for 2D, if you have an infinite system, it will blow up. But if you find a system, then this is still a constant. So then we have loss function, and we just need to figure out what F is. So some quick idea on some vanilla answers. So the simplest one is just the asymmetry like MPS, or you can use a neural network, or you can use ensemble of asymmetries, or you can use ensemble of asymmetries generated by a neural network. So we tried the last one because the first few doesn't seem to work that well. So the ensemble of assumption generated by neural network looks like this. So the input of neural network is operator plus a noise and output the asymmetry, and then you apply the asymmetry on the operator. So this is equivalent to an ensemble of MPS, so which technically should give you have the expressions that create exponential bound dimension if your classical distribution's variance goes large. And here's a demonstration of a neural network. You just input an operator, output a Hermitian operator. So for the classical algorithm we use can use neural network, and because this is a variational principle, and naturally you can also use a quantum ansatz. So in the quantum case, we don't truncate anymore because we don't have to. But what we're gonna do is just to transform the original dynamics to your device dynamics. So how we're gonna do this is we start with our target Hamiltonian, then we transform it to our device Hamiltonian, which is this mapping, and then our device Hamiltonian is parameterized, and then we optimize those parameters by this loss, and then we grow the system, which means you need to calculate dynamics of the system. And then we do this again. So compile them all to to device dynamics. So this form is actually quite nice because you can use a product formula to simulate. For example, you can charterize the evolution of this. And this leads to an alternative algorithm of digital analog quantum simulation, which is some resources exactly available after NISQ. So here's an example of the circuit, one-step circuit. So we have the evolution of the device and the evolution of if your locality is 2, this will be a 2-qubit gate, L tensors I. This kind of resources has been demonstrated in Rydberg system recently, where you can apply one analog evolution and then apply some digital gates and then some digital. So now we try this algorithm with some numerics. So here's the classical one. So we run the three-layer fully connected neural network with a four-time correlation function as our loss function. So here, just to show you that this is a valid variation principle, it leads you to the answer. And loss function converges. And this is the estimated observable.
What's the error bar there?
The error bar. So remember, we have this is one unique feature of this method is you can have an error estimation because of this bound. So just multiply your loss function with this exponential. The actual error is going to be slightly larger than this because of the remainder term.
Sorry, don't you have to know epsilon?
Epsilon is in your loss function, right? Because this is epsilon.
So given your loss function, then you're going to assign an error bar.
Yeah.
Can you please go back to the slide you were in of the theorem where you explain how you can decrease by n plus 1 factorial?
Which one? This one?
Yeah, actually, on the theorem, which is better. There you talk about, so I'm unfamiliar to the field, and it would be great if you can give like one line or one phrase of a general picture of what exactly is happening, discarding the mathematics. This is a qualitative picture of why you get this decrease.
You mean why I get this upper bound?
No. The second paragraph where you are getting the remainder term in the dice and source decreases by particular factor.
Oh, like it was like this prefactor inside the remainder term?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. A qualitative picture would really help for me as well as in your talk to anyone who is not familiar with the actual mechanism of this.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good eye. That's a good suggestion.
Yeah, now that I'm looking at this again, in 2D, you do have an exponential blow up of the error, right? Does this translate to the, you know, the typical DMRG situation where you,
But if you limit to finite size, it's still okay.
So in DMRG, I think the statement is, you know, the bond dimension, what is it, goes as e to the s.
The bond dimension
is the entanglement.
Yeah, but that's on the onsize. But here we don't require on the onsize. It's the local error needs to decrease exponentially.
Mm-hmm. But you can't really beat this, right? Like c is like one. Like if you have a spin operator, then and t you would want to go to in some inverse j or something. So that's also order one.
Yeah, so T, this is going to be exponential TL.
Yeah, so then, oh, I see, you can take epsilon to be like exponentially smaller.
Yeah, and epsilon is something you can control. So if you only look at finite size, then this is kind of fine, but probably going to be hard to optimize. Mm-hmm.
So for 2D, though, when you're growing,
mm-hmm.
you can get away with just growing every one set at a time.
Yes. That's actually the how we are planning to do 2D is you can grow by boundary first. So you don't grow by one. You just grow one, truncate one, grow one, truncate one, then calculate the loss function in the end. Because if you only grow one, the part of the loss function is the same as your next loss function. You don't have to calculate that twice.
Yeah. No, so I'm worried, like, I don't know. How does, because you can't really do the MRG in 2D, right? But, like, with people, so when you're growing by your boundary, do you mean, like, you're adding a bunch of sites at a time?
No, you add one site at a time and then truncate.
Yeah.
And then evaluate the loss function after growing the entire boundary. Because here we remember the procedure here we use doesn't require you to grow one site. What we want is you grow the entire boundary.
Yeah.
And that's when the overlapping set doesn't change anymore. So the last numerics is this currently have simulation have automatic memory issues, but
we go back to the one of the error time evolution.
This
it's amazing.
Is it?
I think it worked. I mean, it
worked. I never know.
I mean it's the error is worse. So the error here is roughly at 10 to the negative 2, where for VMC OT VP you can get 10 to the negative 5. So it's still a big difference.
Yeah, but where is that error? That's in your, you can still improve your.
I guess it looked roughly like it's still decreasing if you train it further, but my guess is the neural network plus the loss function needs to keep improving. Because also discussing in last why I think this is the problem. Maybe let me finish the last two slides. Last one slide.
What's important correlation function?
It's this here. Four times mean you have four C and I J picks. You have four operator C I T J operators in this correlation function.
Mm-hmm.
That's the high order term in the series expansion. So the quantum algorithm kind of works, but the simulation kernel out of memory, but you can still see the loss function decrease and start converging. And it kind of give you something, not entire nonsense right now. What Roger just asked is the improvement is there are quite a few parts. So first of all, we really use a quite dumb ONSAPs, just a neural network. It's three-layer neural network. We want to know more about how expressive this kind of output mapping can be. What's the limitation? The other thing is whether we can start from initial state other than product states, because our current proof kind of relies on row zero to be a product state. But we think it's possible to generalize this condition to matrix product states, because that also follows a grow form. A more interesting perspective from theory is now we only focus on the scaling consistency of observables, but what we really care in physics is some other quantities like phase transition points, like some order parameters. Can we directly calculate those, like preserve those quantities and find scaling consistency condition for those quantities instead of calculate observable first and then estimate those quantities? So this is still something we want to explore. The next thing is if we also don't know if it's a regular scaling consistent station exists for thermal and ground states. We actually tried this numerically. It seems working, but we don't know why. Because our theorem, the trick of our theorem doesn't work for thermal and ground states, because the Dyson series expansion doesn't exist for observable Heisenberg observable under imagining time. Now we can go back to the question you asked initially. Sorry.
Were you saying that the imagining time Dyson series doesn't exist?
Exists for Schrodinger picture, but doesn't exist for observables. Because you can't write it back you can't merge the evolution approach into your observable anymore. You can't merge your evolution operator into your observable anymore because now it's not imaginary number, so they don't cancel each other. I can explain later on Blackboard, maybe that's easier. So the last question is block trick. So initially, remember I mentioned that in some cases you probably don't even need a super block. But now, if we look back to what super block is, it just adds some, and then so it just copy paste to your original system as environment, which as a result, this becomes AK. So then your loss function is just optimizing AK square minus the AK prime square. We spent a lot of time trying to figure out if this has an upper bound, because if you can actually use this, the numerics is much, much easier to calculate. But we don't find this has upper bound, and it seems doesn't. So this is why we're kind of confused why this works for ground state and thermal states, because clearly the MRG works and there must be something we're missing. But if we can find the scaling consistent condition for thermal and ground state, that means we can find the corresponding convergence condition for the MRG. Next, there are also many numerical problems to explore. Now we just brute force calculate the small system, which is actually not necessary, because if you use quantum regression theorem, you can get a set of equations to solve the observable directly. But now we kind of just solve this brute forcefully. And for high dimension term, our theorem doesn't really limit you to calculate the finite size high dimensional term system, but we believe this required clever design of unsized and growing scheme. And now we finally can use can do the original motivation that want to use all the tricks from the small solvers and small differentiable solvers, so which I haven't do yet. So we because small solver is well studied, we know how to do symmetries, we know how to do preserve energy, we know how to do symplectic solvers. So all these tricks can be transferred. And as for the quantum algorithm, there are still some issues if we actually want to do it experimentally. So because we need require you to optimize a bunch of correlation functions, which means you need to calculate a lot of observables. So that is kind of going to be limited by Schall rate and noise. The other problem is although our vibrational part is bounded, which is the device Hamiltonian, but the digital part is not. It highly depends on the accuracy of your digital gate. So how does noise affect the growth of the system is unknown. That's all my talk. Thank you.
Roger, I had one question. Yeah, so like in the neural network that you showed, I think it's like 25. I'm not sure it's like 25. Yeah, so in the first one, you have noise. Why do you have noise again?
Because we want to create an ensemble of symmetry P. On the sample, we want to create a classical distribution and then sample some symmetry from it.
Oh.
And also, like, how are we formatting it?
Just flat them to vector. we just do the dumbest way. It's really not something special.
Yeah, it might be worth like, you know, using like the generic or something.
Yeah.
Something more like, I don't know, geometrically sound, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For example, I imagine you could preserve like quantum numbers in the transform. But that's something we need to explore to design clever unsized so we can do that.
So wait, X is your input state?
Is the operator.
Operator.
So remember the how we define our abstraction of the system. So you have Hamiltonian observable density matrix plus the connecting operator.
So X was which operator?
X will be all these operator.
All
yes. And also the, so basically any operator you want to use from the old system, you need to let them go through this mapping to tell you what's the corresponding operator in your new system. Yes.
X is all three of those? Yes, for that.
All three of those and all the connecting operator and all the correlation operator.
Yes, the system.
So why not
a different neural network? Yes, you can. I mean, you can do that.
I mean, yeah, because I'm just thinking that like each one has like a different structure to it, right?
Actually, each one in TFM case, it's all these. So and the other it's more numerical, kind of. I didn't mention is we find this one thing this plays nicely with a small exact solver is a trick usually people use is you don't directly simulate a Schrodinger or a Heisenberg equation by constructing the full matrix of Hamiltonian. We usually just construct the time-dependent Hamiltonian. We construct each time-dependent sector, and each sector are constant, and you have a time-dependent prefactor. So because now we just ask for whatever operator we want to use, so we can preserve this form of Hamiltonian to using the in the other system, which as a result, you get a you actually make a small system solver much happier.
Does the noise here have to be Gaussian as usual for the isometries to be correctly generated?
We currently use Gaussian, but it's more like a random choice.
Uh-huh.
We think it might make more sense to actually use like flow models or diffusion models,
mm-hmm.
Which actually is more strictly describe a classical distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But here it's more like an initial dumb demo.
How would you use diffusion models here again?
Yeah, path pending, 1 qubit.
Yeah.
This top to bottom be a diffusion model.
Yeah. So you just diffuse from a Gaussian noise to, and this will be your so then generate a some distribution of asymmetries and a sample from the asymmetries.
I mean, like in diffusion model, you want to learn some distribution at the end, right? Like
yes. So here I want to learn the distribution of asymmetries.
Oh, so you're okay.
So it's
going to
be a conditional distribution
given the operator.
Yes.
Classical distribution.
Also, the dimensions should be the same, right? Like the dimension of x and x hat and x bar.
X.
And in the
this. This?
Yeah.
Oh, this is the naive neural network. So we also tried the naive neural network. This currently somehow generates generates an operator with a very large norm. We don't know why, but this currently blows up the numerics. So I don't show the result of these.
Can you just normalize it?
So we also find normalizing it doesn't work. So this doesn't seem to be a good answer. How big it what?
How big are each of those axes? It's usually just a few sites.
Yeah, it's just like a 8x8 operator, or it depends on the where you start and how much you truncate. It's a tunable hyperparameter. It's like the bound dimension. It's basically the same as bound dimension.
Yeah.
I think it's something basic. So when you're doing time evolution, so are you? Is that the time steps also connected to the number of course reading steps?
That's actually a very good question. I didn't talk about this, but so ideally in this ansatz, it should give you the same result as TDVP because they are strictly equivalent. But we didn't do this because in order to do this exactly like TDVP, you need to have a different asymmetry at each time step. So that seems more complicated to implement, but mathematically, if you want to make sure you remake the TDVP results, that's the answer you should try, and I think that should be equivalent to TDVP.
So how do I read time off? Like how do I input time?
So remember the idea that every time you want to use an operator, you pass it to your map. So in each time step, I want to use the HT operator. I just put T into H, get the current operator in the original system, and then feed into, there are actually two ways. The naive way is this, and then feed into your F, and that tells you what's the corresponding operator at this time. The other way is what I said, how people do a small system simulation where you divide your time-dependent Hamiltonian to each time-independent sectors, and you have some scalar time-dependent function. And then each sector is a constant matrix, describes how the what's the each Hamiltonian term, and then you just apply that app to tell you what's the corresponding term in your new system. This is how actually we do the the quantum algorithm, which is because Rydberg Hamiltonian here is time-dependent Hamiltonian, and the original Hamiltonian is a time-dependent Hamiltonian. So we just ask what the corresponding dynamic status should be. I'm sure there are going to be other way to fake the dynamics. Don't limit by the two thing idea I talked about.
Can't you use time as a conditioning variable in your neural network?
Yes. In principle, you can. We also didn't really try that. There are quite different way, lots. I think there are lots of different ways to fake dynamic. So basically, idea is all this comes from duck typing and differential programming. They're saying, if someone asks you to make a F1 car, I can give him a bike first, and then he'll complain, this is not fast enough. So I put an engine on it. And he'll complain again, this the wind is blowing too much, and I put a shield on it. So this is like that process.
But I guess the question is, I guess the problem with ground state is we have to actually take time to infinity, right? Like the imaginary time.
For what?
For the imaginary time, if you want to get to the ground state correlation function.
So it's mainly because our the trick we use to prove theorem two doesn't work on imaginary time because to do serial expansion on this, you need to first do a perturbation on your time evolution operator and then insert the time evolution operator as the identities between each observable product. But problem is, if you're in measured time, you can't insert the identities anymore. So we don't know how to rewrite your system in original system observable. So that's currently bottlenecks this.
So I got two questions. First off, I really don't get the analogy to duck. You know, you're calling me duck RG, and I'm supposed to see a duck here somewhere, man.
Okay, I'll put a duck.
I really need it. Put a duck somewhere on the slide. I really don't see it.
Should it be goose or PI?
Yeah.
Goose RG.
Goose. But just what does this have to do with duck type right here?
Oh, because that's basically follows the idea. If you just make a server property, you just preserve server property, not all of the property.
Okay. I think since you named it duck RG, maybe come back to that on the slide.
Okay.
This is the analogy somehow that I don't get.
Yes, basically, since all the observables are the same, preserved, then it to you, it's effectively a duck.
Right.
Yeah.
You see it, and everything that you observe is the same.
Yeah, but we actually fake something else.
Yeah.
It's not actually the.
So it's because you use observables as a loss.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's the duck.
Yeah, that's the duck.
Yeah. Maybe then take the slide where you show the classical typing versus duck typing. Maybe show that near the introduction, and then give us schematics about how the duck typing comes up in your work. So that the audience gets an idea why it's different than the usual approach that people take.
Uh-huh. So you mean like put duck typing in the beginning and then mention it again in the
end? Let's come back to it somewhere. Like,
yeah.
You talked about duck typing as a motivation, and it was hard to understand how,
Okay. Let me take a note.
Also, if you can make a small Dixie diagram for the how the duck typing is analogous to what you have done. That's number one. And also a small Dixie diagram, even as ChatGPT to give you something very good. For your very first slide, where we describe the set of Hamiltonian as some of different Hamiltonians, observables, some of different observables. So it's more of a comment, but the one takeaway is that because you are discussing a lot of detail in a small span of time, people lose track of the flow of sentences, and if you give more diagrammatic representation, they will just easily capture that.
Okay.
I got one of my second question. So go to your talk, the time-dependent site. Time-dependent.
Yes.
Once you violate the bounds at the end, all these bounds that this proof I had to listen to.
Oh,
don't you violate it right there?
So
your orange point outside of that.
Yeah, so that basically meaning my loss function order needs to be higher because the remainder term is not small enough.
Wait. I mean, you know your epsilon, right? Did you put your epsilon as input into that error bar?
Yeah, and there's a remainder term.
Oh.
That's the part of it. So we only get a lower bound estimation of the error.
What?
A lower bound of the upper bound.
It's because this decreases exponentially. Yeah.
Does that make mathematical sense? Okay. So wait, can you calculate RM?
I'm not sure actually.
I don't,
I can't calculate RM because it depends on how the term of the truncated system, and we don't know, we can't calculate that.
I see. The only thing you know about RM is that it dies with n plus one, right?
Yeah, RM actually comes from
the asymptotic form.
Yeah,
so you know the asymptotic form, okay?
Yeah,
so you don't know if you're anywhere near that asymptote,
yeah. So I mean, because RM it comes from the remainder of this series expansion, this series expansion.
So you only have this bound. You only really know this bound in the asymptotic limit.
Yeah. So we don't actually know what this is.
So
yeah,
it's a little bound.
So I don't know. What was your algorithm is to train this f function, right? And that's basically all you're doing during this whole procedure.
Yes.
You're just training f.
Yes. So you can also see this as a machine learning process where you want to use the data from your small system solver to find a mapping that give you the best fixed system, and then once you have the best fixed system, you can do this again.
And then also. So then your input state row that you're right now, you said you're just using a proxy.
Yes. Okay. Because you need to rewrite, you need to grow your state of density operator. And if it's a product state, it's very easy to write growing it.
So I mean, you only pass this row through its expectation value, so, right?
Yes.
So you don't even need row, you just need something that gives you expectation values. Okay,
but if you don't have row, you can't reuse, you can put that in a small system solver to produce the new observable. Because we're faking the entire system. You need everything.
You get up the oracle.
Yeah, you're building an oracle. So you need to make sure you give you everything you need.
No, I'm just saying, could you, I don't know, once you've got an F trained, right? Could you fix that and start training, I don't know, an RN or something? Use this procedure.
Not sure.
I don't know, basically just kind of would this allow you to sort of apply the MRG to environment or something?
I don't know what that would be.
Yeah. So how does this solver work? What do you mean by the solver? You mean optimizing that L?
Uh-huh.
That's for your
small solver. No, solver just tells you the value of observables. So in order to calculate the time involved observable, you need to know all the corresponding operator you need to put in the solver, like the Hamiltonian and the state, just like how you solve a standard small system.
Oh, okay. So you need
Yes, the full Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
So in principle, you can also just, you don't have to compile it to arbitrary Hamiltonian. Like in the quantum case, we compile to a regular Hamiltonian. But you still need this thing. You need to get something.
So, I mean, I guess you kind of still have an exponential out of
that. Yes. So this dimension is fixed. It's like you. So it's always a small system, right? Because for quantum algorithm, we don't truncate, so that's exponential, but it's fine. But for a classical algorithm, because here you truncate, so it stays as small system.
Okay, let's call it 5 minutes until free food. Thank you, Roger.